1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the 45th anniversary of Alice Cooper's number one selling album.
I think a lot of true musical people that were really into music and that was their life, we were an embarrassment to them because they couldn't say they didn't like our music. They liked our music, but they just couldn't digest the image. You know, and everything that was sacred to them, we kind of spit on. Those things were dangerous. The blade on the guillotine was a 40-pound razor-sharp blade. And if I didn't do the timing right on it, it would cut your head off.
Never conceived of a billion-dollar babies.
I wouldn't do any of those things. Alice would do all of them.
This is Alice Cooper. Welcome back to my nightmare in the studio with Redbeard.
This was not the way Vincent Furnier's parents intended him to turn out. Vince was a preacher's son, born in Detroit, raised in the suburbs of Phoenix, Arizona. A bright boy, not at all inclined to put on his mother's makeup or chase neighbor kids with a meat cleaver. So who would have guessed that Vincent would grow up to become Alice Cooper? Indeed, he did, creating one of the most outlandish characters rock and roll audiences have ever seen. Alice Cooper is the true father of shock rock, and their sixth album, Billion Dollar Babies, is, quote, the group's climax of sorts, and one of the best rock and roll records of all time. In its own way, it's up there with London Calling by The Clash, Nevermind from Nirvana, and The Beatles' Revolver, contends New Times writer Brian Smith in the liner notes of the Billion Dollar Babies Deluxe Anniversary Edition. Alice Cooper spawned progeny from Kiss to Johnny Rotten, Motley Crue to Marilyn Manson. But unlike many who followed in his wake, Alice Cooper's appeal wasn't solely based on flash pots and fake blood. Snakes and guillotines aside, Alice Cooper has been responsible for some of the 70s most enduring hard rock anthems. The album Billion Dollar Babies perched at number one in the US and the UK, and as writer Brian Smith reminds us, I quote, the Alice Cooper group was giving life to the grand pop star myth because they had to. It was their job, end quote. That's why many people assumed that Alice was as twisted in real life as he was on stage. No way, insists Alice Cooper.
I play Alice. I don't live Alice. If I had to be Alice off stage, I tried that and it nearly killed me. You know, I think Jim Morrison played Jim Morrison off stage, and I think Keith Moon played Keith Moon and it killed him. You can't take that character off the stage. I think somebody as intense as Alice can only live on stage. He doesn't belong in society. The only place he belongs is on stage. When I take my first step on stage and the audience sees Alice for the first time, I become Alice. Not a second sooner or later.
Hello, Hooray, which opens Alice Cooper's Billion Dollar Babies album, a fanfare of sorts.
And that was also the opening song in the show, the Billion Dollar Baby show. It was just, we really wanted a big opening. The whole band would actually go to Broadway shows when it was very unhip to go. You know, I mean, we would tie our hair back or whatever and go to the Broadway shows, and we'd go see everything. And, you know, when there's that opening number that everybody goes, wow, that sets up the show. Well, I said, we need one of those. Let's not start the show with, like, our all-out rocker. Let's start the show and build it.
And build it they certainly did. To this day, the Billion Dollar Babies tour remains one of the more extravagant rock shows ever produced. But the song that paved the way for the success of Billion Dollar Babies, the album and tour, had been released early in the summer of 1972, announcing that school's out.
The moment we recorded it, I think it was on the radio the next day. The album went to number one, I think, in 3 weeks. And the single was like number one, I think, everywhere in 2 or 3 weeks. It was perfect timing. Everybody wanted to hear that. Everybody had gone through the experience of sitting in biology class the last 2 weeks of school going, when is this going to end? And it also was the kind of thing where School's Out was saying something else. It was also saying, wise up. Don't get pushed around. School's out. You know, and it was really telling the generation, you know, lots of different things. But basically, it was the celebration that school is out.
That was Alice Cooper's biggest single ever, his first to break top 10. It was the song that turned Alice Cooper from cult figure to a mainstream attraction.
Everybody loved it. Even people that hated Alice Cooper loved the record. There was no way of stopping it, and there was so much fun to talk about on the radio, this Alice character. And the press wouldn't leave Alice alone. And so, I mean, we weren't just in Rolling Stone. We were in Time. We were on the cover of Forbes magazine. And so, like, it was the whole world was obsessed with this character. They were going, who is this guy? And is he smart? Is he stupid? Is he, like, from heaven, from hell? Where is he from? And why does he keep contradicting everything that we think is right? And, you know, no matter what it was fun. Alice Cooper was fun.
For a couple of years before Alice Cooper became a mainstay on American radio, the band was a major concert draw. People wanted to see just how outrageous he would be. And beginning when I first saw them headline as early as summer 1971, Alice Cooper had consistently escalated that level of macabre madness. There were huge snakes, decapitated baby dolls, an electric chair, and frighteningly realistic gallows for hanging. It was like a comic book or scary movie, only louder.
I think every show to me was a surrealistic thing because I couldn't believe that I was actually on stage and there were thousands of people there to watch me go through this musical insanity, even though it was all prepared and we knew it was good. We knew that it was, you know, that it was very effective, and it took months and years of work to get it to this point. To me, it was still like just amazing every single, and still is, every single night that people are just so knocked out by the production of the show and by the music and by the image of Alice. People were so, their imaginations were so tweaked by Alice that he became like a household word. And to me, when I said, well, what is he? He's the greatest villain in rock and roll. I mean, this guy, what was he doing up there? He was chopping up baby dolls. They were hanging him. They were electrocuting him. They were all in the name of pure rock and roll insanity. There was nothing ever religious about it. There was no Satanism involved at all. You know, I mean, that's the last thing that I would want to project as anything satanic. But it was like a roller coaster ride through hell, except that everybody came back, maybe not the same mental state that they were in, but, you know, the idea was to really give everybody a roller coaster ride.
When the album Billion Dollar Babies hit in early 1973, Richard Nixon had just been inaugurated for a second term as president, but the Watergate scandal was threatening to unravel what had just been the biggest presidential landslide in election history. The times seemed ripe for Alice Cooper's cynical brand of political satire.
To us, real politics was boring. We would rather make up our own politics. When we did Madison Square Garden, we had the guy that did the Richard Nixon impersonation come on stage. He looked exactly like Richard Nixon, this guy did. And I mean, we just beat him to death up there. We just beat him up. We kicked him, and the audience went crazy. And he was still at his, you know, his peace signs going on and everything like this. It was like, that made Time magazine. They loved that, you know. But I mean, because we did it, everybody in the country wanted to do that at the time. But it was a great satire. It was a good satire. You know, first of all, just the idea of Richard Nixon showing up on Alice Cooper's stage. And we did the same thing with Santa Claus, too. So, I mean, you know, nothing was sacred with Alice.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Alice Cooper for Billion Dollar Babies.
This is Alice Cooper. Welcome back to my nightmare in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks, Alice. By the time the Alice Cooper Band recorded it, they realized just how ironic and outrageous their success story was. The title song was Alice Cooper's way of shrugging it off.
It was so ridiculous that we were getting as much money as we were getting. And we looked at what we were, and we were just a bunch of brats. So we said, what aren't we? Billion Dollar Babies. And we kind of like took the money on stage, and we'd throw money in the audience. We take a couple thousand dollars a night and just throw it back in the audience and just say, here. I used to have money on the end of a sword, and I'd stick it out there, and I'd just let him grab it, and it was just sort of like feeding piranha.
Featuring a vocal duet with 60s troubadour Donovan, that's the title song to Alice Cooper's number one seller, Billion Dollar Babies, the fourth Alice album to be produced by Bob Ezrin, who was brought in by early believer Frank Zappa to polish the Alice Cooper sound. Remember, before Bob Ezrin began producing them, Alice Cooper's notoriety was for how perversely bad they sounded. Ezrin helped them focus on the music by recording in London.
That was all done in London at Morgan Studios. And it was great because we had people dropping in. There are still people on that album that people never knew were on it. Mark Bolan played guitar on that album, T-Rex. And Harry Nilsson played on that album. Keith Moon played on that album. It was just like everybody that dropped into the studio, we said, hey, play this, you know, or play that. Donovan, I did the song Billion Dollar Babies, I did as a duet with Donovan. He was in the next studio, and I pulled him in. I said, you know, you sing too many ballads. Come and sing on this. And, but at the time, everybody was so drunk that we didn't remember who played on what. So, you know, I remember them carrying Mark Bolan out, and Harry Nilsson's trying to carry Mark Bolan out, and Harry was drunker than Mark. You know, and we weren't exactly seeing straight. So, I mean, when we got done with the album, we listened to it and we said, who played that?
There's a picture from your vocal sessions recording Billion Dollar Babies in England. I guess that would have been Morgan, maybe?
Oh, yeah, Morgan Studios.
That I'll never forget. It shows.
Yeah, Harry was in there and Mark Bolan and Ringo and Rick Gretsch. And I mean, it was
Keith is there around this shot.
Yeah. And that was a night that, you've heard of the lost weekend. That was the lost session. Because in the end, the next morning, we don't remember who played what on what. But I know T-Rex is somewhere on the Billion Dollar Babies record. Rick Gretsch is playing something there. Ringo was playing piano or something. Harry Nilsson was... everybody took a different instrument. Something that they didn't normally play, except Mark Bolan played guitar. And we don't remember who played on what. When we started doing the credits, it was a big question mark, you know.
Well, you could certainly draw a crowd even then. Why do you think so many superstars of the day in 72 were drawn to you then so relatively early in your career?
I think for one thing is that we were a relentless hard rock, guitar rock band. And we weren't going to go left or right or up and down. That's what we did was hard rock. And I always surrounded myself with gunslingers, you know, guitar players that were just the slickest guitar players around. And I still do. You know, I've got three guitar players in my band now, Nita Strauss, Hurricane Nita Strauss and Ryan Roxy and Tommy Henriksen. You know, it's like you surround yourself with great players. And then everything gets a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on a record like this, you can imagine when you go in to record and everybody there is the best on their instrument.
Yeah. For four decades, the mainstream press has used Alice Cooper's theatricality as a benchmark to compare everybody from Ziggy Stardust era David Bowie to Kiss in the 70s, Motley Crue in the 80s, and Marilyn Manson in the 90s. Alice Cooper refused to take the bait.
The one thing, was that we never made enemies. You know, I always made sure that there was never enemies made because I said, that doesn't do anybody any good. I never had a feud with David Bowie. I never had a feud with Kiss. I never had a feud. The press tried to invent them. They wanted me to be at odds with Bowie because he did theatrics. And I said, well, yeah, but he doesn't do anything like me. He's created a new character. It's nothing like Alice. You know, Kiss. They said, well, come on now, Kiss. You know, and I said, look, Kiss came out and they said, if one Alice Cooper works, then four ought to work. And I said, they said that. I didn't say that. They said that. I said, so they've already committed to where they got it, and I'm fine with that. And their show was nothing like Alice Cooper.
That's true.
You know, I was the Phantom of the Opera. They were Marvel Comics. So I never had a problem with Kiss. You know, people wanted there to be a problem, but I just refused to fall into that.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Alice Cooper for Billion Dollar Babies.
This is Alice Cooper. Welcome back to my nightmare in the studio with Redbeard.
Looking back never fails to compress time, but in the case of the explosive popularity of Alice Cooper, his and the band's lives had become as restrictive as the straitjacket Alice wore on stage every night. In the 3 years, 1971 to 1974, Alice Cooper recorded 5 full albums and toured to promote every one. Coping mechanisms were employed to try to just keep up.
Oh, those things were dangerous. The blade on the guillotine was a 40-pound razor-sharp blade. And if I didn't do the timing right on it, it would cut your head off. I was pretty sure it wasn't going to happen because, I mean, I knew what I was doing up there. But, I mean, it was as dangerous as anything Houdini ever did. I had, you know, I mean, I had a couple of, like, secondary things on it that would save me. But, I mean, there, I would lower it and lower it because the lower the safety got, the closer it came to actually hitting me, the better it looked. So once you got really used to doing it, then I would say, okay, lower that so it'll really look close. But I mean, it was a 40-pound blade that literally missed me by about 8 inches every night. And the hanging was the same thing. I mean, the hanging was like the actual rope hitting my throat was about a quarter inch from my throat. But in order to make it look right, you had to make it look real. Again, we were in the great brat position that we could do anything we wanted to and nobody could say we couldn't. So anything that we decided that would be funny or anything that we decided that was going to be, you know, controversial, we just did it. It's great not to have to answer to anybody. The snake is still the easiest thing in the world to work with on stage because they love being on stage. They're deaf, for one thing. They have no hearing. And they love the warmth of the lights. They love they don't mind the audience at all. In fact, you know, when I put them down towards the audience, they love that. So there's really, the only thing that they are affected by is adrenaline. If you're holding a snake and it doesn't feel secure, it's going to tense up on you. It's going to wrap around because you're like a tree. It doesn't want to fall. It has no way of stopping its fall. So, everything, and they're pure muscle. And I mean, this one snake I had, Yvonne, was like, she was about 13 feet long, and she weighed about 75 pounds, and she was solid muscle. So if she wanted to, like, snap you in half, it would be absolutely no problem.
Not everything was fun and games, though, even then for Alice Cooper, the real-life flesh-and-blood guy who had to survive while Alice would come out and play on stage.
Yeah, it was hard for me because I had always had the successful formula of Alice Cooper, a half a bottle of VO before the show, you know, of Seagram's VO, and the makeup and everything. And for 10 years, you know, or for as long as I had been touring, it worked every single night. I never saw an audience that wasn't standing up all the way through the show screaming their heads off. So what happens is you look at that formula and why should I change anything? The only problem was I got to one point where I'd look at my stage costume, I'd look at the makeup, I'd look at the bottle. I wanted to be on stage and I would get physically sick before I'd go on stage and I'd throw up. I'd be throwing up blood, you know, and it's because of the fact that finally everything worked except the fact that your body cannot take that much alcohol. And I'd lived on the road for about 6 or 7 years where we literally lived in Holiday Inns. And your best friend becomes a television and a bottle of whiskey. And so I got to the point where I hated whiskey, but I loved it at the same time. I was truly addicted to the effect that it had on me, not the taste of it, not anything else. So when I had to become Alice Cooper, when I finally, you know, cleaned up and said, okay, now I'm going to go out and do the Constrictor tour, the Nightmare Returns tour, and I've got to do it straight, I was going, you know, wait a minute, what if Alice doesn't show up? We just never quit working. It was just like constant. If we finished a tour, we went right into the studio. I mean, writing just sort of came during the road or whatever. But I mean, whatever it was nonstop. In some ways was great because, I mean, we were young, ready to go, you know, unstoppable. And we had billions of ideas to work with. And people wanted more and more and more and more and more. The only problem was after four or five albums, you know, and five or six world tours, and you guys want to stop now? Nah, let's do another album. Let's do another tour. We didn't live anywhere. We didn't have a house. We didn't live, you know, we had a lot of money, but nobody ever spent anything, you know, because we didn't have time. It was like the kind of thing where like we just kept going and going and going. And that's when I actually really developed the alcoholism. Because it was the kind of thing where, like, it was an everyday thing of me drinking, traveling, working, drinking, traveling. There was no such thing as a home life at all. That really, you know, and I didn't recognize it as being alcoholism until I slowed down and said, okay, let's stop now and take 3 months off. And during that 3 months, though, I didn't stop drinking. See? And then we'd go back on tour and everything, and it was okay still. And then finally, after 10 years of that, I realized that that drink was very, very much a part of my hand. When people ask me, you know, about the alcoholism, there's nothing to be ashamed of. I did it. You know, I mean, I drank most of California and New York. And thank God I'm alive. I mean, for some reason, he still wants me around, I guess. And it's the kind of thing where, like, I should have, on many occasions, not have been here. Well, you know, the 70s was a very strange period. I don't know what it was. It was sort of like a free-for-all out there. Everybody that was, I mean, we did the International Rock Awards, and I saw David Bowie, and I had Keith Richards, and Eric Clapton, and Lou Reed, and I was standing there looking at us. We were all drinking Diet Cokes. And, you know, I said, they should be giving us an award just for being alive. In the 70s, it was sort of like they sent out a squadron of rock and rollers, and the ones that came back ended up being heroes. The ones that died, you know, they went down with the ships. But it was very hard because everything was very, it was just sort of like nothing illegal at the time. And even though it was illegal, the rock and roll business, it was very hip to be out of your mind most of the time. As now is that drugs and alcohol is very looked down on. If somebody says, you know, that guy in the 70s, if somebody says, yeah, that guy's into smoking bass, everybody would go, ooh, you know, that's pretty hip. Now, if somebody says, oh, yeah, that guy's into bass, everybody goes, oh, gee, that's too bad. Because we've been educated now. We realize the fact that drugs are so destructive. And if you're a musician, you know, the last thing you need is something else in your way. I mean, the business is hard enough without putting another stumbling block in your way. Just self-destruction in front of the public was sort of like something that was a very in thing at the time. Let's see how wrecked this guy is this week. Let's see how messed up this is. Let's see how wiped out Alice is tonight. It was a very strange period of time. I don't know why self-destruction was a very in thing. I think people kind of looked at the rock musicians and they were doing it for them. Absolutely. We were like, you know. And everybody would say, every time something that I'd hear a rumor about myself, it would be some ridiculous rumor that I couldn't even write. And people would go, they loved it. Especially the more vile things that Alice did or that Ozzy did or that, you know, that Jagger did or Bowie or whatever. And so, you know, it was very funny. We would sit there and read these things and go, wow, that's a good one. And that one's a good one. I like that one. I mean, not to say that we didn't do a lot of that stuff. But I mean, some of the things were like even better than the Inquirer. But sometimes the fiction is much more fun, you know. And so like when you're an entertainer and your name is out there and you can't do anything about it, then sometimes the more absurd the rumor is, the more fun it is. You sit there and you go, nobody's going to believe that one. And then, but people do. It's like wrestling. For me, it wasn't hard because of the fact that my stage show was the most probably theatrical, absurd stage show of all time. And so I loved the publicity, and I still do. I mean, I have no, you know, if I have a choice of picking up the New York Times or the Inquirer, I go for baby born with three heads. You know, I mean, I'm going to go for, you know, UFO lands on the White House, you know, lawn every time. So, I mean, I'm a sensationalist to start with, and my stage show is always going to be a very theatrical stage show, no matter what my music will do this and this and this, but my stage show will always be theatrical. So I love the absurd publicity.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guest, Alice Cooper. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.